Hi, I'm Carol Off, co-host of As It Happens, bringing you the stories behind the stories of the day, Mondays through Thursdays at 11 p.m., heard only in the Bay Area on KALW San Francisco.
KALW San Francisco, State of the Bay, is next.
Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
On tonight's show, we'll discuss the pros and cons of making outdoor dining parklets permanent. We'll hear from John King, the urban design critic from the San Francisco Chronicle, and Lori Thomas, executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association.
And then we'll hear our co-host Joseph Pache's interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Branch. But first, California officially reopens tomorrow, which means capacity restrictions and physical distancing requirements at restaurants and bars will be gone. So after months eating outdoors, diners can finally move inside. But will they do that? Outdoor dining spaces and sidewalk tables have proliferated during the pandemic, and regulators at the state and city levels are now moving to make them permanent. So I've really loved, personally, eating at parklets over the last few months, and as popular as they seem to be, they have raised concerns about access, noise, safety, and, of course, loss of parking. So here tonight to discuss these issues and more, we're pleased to be joined by John King, urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, John.
Thank you so much. It's fun to be on.
Glad you can join us. And we're also joined by Lori Thomas, executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association and owner of Nice Ventures, which currently owns and manages two successful restaurants in San Francisco, Rose's Cafe and Terzo. Welcome, Lori.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start first with you, John. And I wanted to first highlight an article you read. You highlighted some of the most impressive or best designed parklets that you've seen in the city. And I just wanted to start there for those who, you know, I think many of the listeners in the city, of course, have seen these parklets. But I'm just wondering if you could paint a picture of what you think are some of the most interesting designed parklets that you've seen in the city.
Well, what's kind of fun about this is that the interesting ones tend to change constantly, just the novelty of them. I mean, it's almost like we've been seeing this laboratory of outside living going on. And so it's the kind of thing that I particularly enjoy almost structurally. Some of the ones, there's a bar on Columbus that's next to Specs that has one that is tiered. So as Columbus is going up, it's adjusting to the level of Columbus. There's also one over in Chinatown, just up from Portsmouth Square, that does that. There is a steakhouse that's off Chestnut Street in the Marina that has essentially, they managed to replicate the feel of outdoors, of indoors, outdoors, but not in a closed off way, just trying to really roll out all the little extras to make things better. And then one, and I'll finish up, there's one down at the Kezar Pub near Golden Gate Park that had to be pretty low tech and low budget, but it managed to just kind of roll out the convivial feel of a good bar for like watching a Warriors game or something like that. And, you know, toss a little bit of hay here and a few vertical elements there and bingo, you've got, you know, it's almost like a little beach club in Cabo Cabo or something.
Well, I would love nothing better to go to Cabo Cabo, so I can't wait till that opens, John. But I wanted to turn to you, Lori, and tell us, you know, before we just dive into this discussion of whether these spaces should be permanent, tell us how important outdoor dining has been to you and your fellow restaurateurs during the pandemic.
Well, thanks for asking. And I would say it has been critical. right up there with the, you know, the federal relief that people have been able to try to access. Without the outdoor spaces, many restaurants just weren't able to operate at all. I can say anecdotally, as a restaurant operator, we gave it a go back in December when we went into the Deep Purple with Rosa's Cafe, and we lost about 1.5 times how much we would have spent on rent and just closing the doors to try to just go and do to-go and delivery. So there are multiple types of restaurants, and some would have just lived on to-go and delivery, like pizza places, for example. But most of us desperately need to seat customers and have them dine on premise, whether it's outside or inside, to have any hope at making any money.
And Lori, I know these were basically emergency measures that the city put in when COVID hit. But can you just describe a bit of the regulatory framework for putting these in place? Under what conditions were they first allowed to be put out on the sidewalk?
Sure. So So let me take a step back, though, and just try to clear up something that I don't know that everybody knows, which is for probably 25 to 30 years now, San Francisco has had a tables and chair permit, a legally permitted, codified in code permit process that restaurants and cafes could apply, meeting the guidelines, holding a 6-foot clear passage through the complicated permit process of San Francisco, paying thousands of dollars a year to be able to do that. So that had always existed. What hadn't existed was utilizing the true public spaces, which were the parking spaces. We can come back to whether that's a public use or not, but as defined, it's, you know, a street space. And so that was what was added, plus a lot of streamlining of the tables and chairs on the sidewalk thing. You didn't have to go through the hearings, the detailed architectural drawings, all of those things. That was all sort of waived in the interest of trying to help do what we could to support the businesses. And it was done through a very powerful mechanism called the executive order. And I see Supervisor Safai has joined us. He can explain more how that executive order works. I will cede my time to him, but that was how it was done.
Well,
all right, well,
go ahead, Ethan.
Well, I was going to say we are joined now by Supervisor Asha Safai, who we wanted to talk to about shoplifting and the rise of that. So we're going to get to that in our next segment. But we wanted him to join us now for this segment because he represents District 11 in the city. And he has been involved in some of the proposals to keep this program permanent. So first of all, Supervisor Safai, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay. And I wanted to ask you then what the status is currently. What's your proposal to make these parklets permanent? And can you give us an update on what the sort of the politics of this might be?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we went through a long legislative process. It's gone through many rounds. I've worked on legislation before that's gone through multiple committee hearings. This is a 70-page piece of legislation, so it's not something that's going to get done overnight, but we have the time, we have the energy, we have the support. We're going to do everything we can to ensure that this is finalized really soon. I think there were some tweaks that were done. There's some concerns, some concerns about ADA accessibility. There's some concerns about where ultimately this department will rest, this program will rest. But ultimately, I think there's really strong consensus around ensuring that this is a permanent program, ensuring that this is something that retail, particularly restaurants and cafes, can benefit from after the hellish year that they've had. So sorry I was a little late. We're juggling our budget committee hearings this week. They're still ongoing. We have 17 departments today. So apologize a little bit for my tardiness.
Oh, that's fine.
But I'm happy to be here.
We're really happy that you're here, too. And I guess one of the issues that comes up from a regulatory perspective on those parklets is access for the disabled. If you're trying to get around the city, it's already hard to begin with. What do you say to critics who say that it just makes it harder to get around San Francisco?
Well, first of all, I think that that can't be taken lightly. So I think that there was a lot of work that was done and just to respond to try and keep some of these businesses from surviving. A lot of them that cannot be made ADA accessible, that are in a bus stop, that are in a corner that are not, you know, safe, that are blocking a sidewalk completely. There's a lot of work that's going to have to get done. So there's time and built in to ensure that they're ADA accessible. So that's not something to be taken lightly or dismissed. So we're going to do everything we can. And those safeguards are written in. So that's something that is a priority in this program for sure.
Well, and this is not as significant as ADA access, but the subject of alcohol. Can we have a glass of wine out in these parklets? What's the status of being able to serve alcohol in these parklets?
Absolutely. The governor has put some legislation forward that will allow localities to pass enabling legislation ordinances to ensure that that's still a major part of what needs to be done. So under the emergency ordinance, many restaurants were allowed to do takeout or serve or put alcohol outside as part of their initiative. But as regulated by ABC, that was put under temporary authorization. The governor wants to make that permanent, which would allow San Francisco then to do the same for sure.
Well, I mean, alcohol seems to be critical to a restaurant survival. What do you say about that, Lori? I mean, if you were not allowed to serve alcohol in the parklets, would they even be worth doing?
Oh, well, not nearly as much. And I just want to reiterate what the supervisor was saying is that the governor just announced, I think it was a week ago, that they would be extending the ABC guidelines that will allow us to serve in the parking lanes and to have the to-go cocktails and things continue through the end of December. There are two pieces of legislation, AB 314, Senator Wiener's legislation would allow it to continue in the parklets more permanently, and then Senator Dodd's AB 389, I think it is, for the to-go cocktails. And the goal was to try to make those permanent, but that's why the governor bought us that time through December. And I just want to mention that the temporary parklets and shared spaces program, you know, is in place now through December to let us do what the supervisor was saying, which was work through some very complicated, guidance to try to get to a win-win solution for everybody. And that's what we've all been heads down working on for the past several months.
Well, that's
one other concern that you hear about is concern around safety. And there was recently an accident or collision, I should say, down in San Jose. And when you have pedestrians out sharing the roadway with drivers, you know, this is definitely an area of concern. So I guess starting with you, Supervisor Safai, what are some of the concerns that you've heard and the ways to address this issue of safety?
Well, as I said, a lot of what was done initially to get things done quickly to help act as a lifeline for many of these restaurants, cafes, and other businesses. But as we start to make these permanent, we are ensuring that safety is a priority. We're ensuring that ADA accessibility is a priority. We're ensuring that access is a priority. So all these things will be taken into consideration. As I said, some were put in places that are on a corner that undermine our goals of Vision Zero, which is pedestrian and vehicular safety. Those would not be allowed to remain as permanent. Something in a bus stop would not be allowed to remain as permanent. So there's a whole host of things that have to be addressed. And safety is the number one concern, of course, because if someone doesn't feel safe being in along a major commercial corridor, that they could be in an accident, of course, they're going to ensure that, you know, that people wouldn't want to utilize that. Also, let me just make a point. There's three different ways. There's some that could be set up during the day and then removed at night when after business hours. There's ones that are more permanent. And then there's a little bit of a compromise in between. So we're giving people all the options. The other thing, too, that we really want to ensure is that there's equity across the board. A business downtown that has a certain level of gross receipts versus a smaller neighborhood business shouldn't necessarily be asked to pay the same fee. We also know that some of the businesses have the ability to do a different level of shared space. If it's a permanent space, they have the money and the resources to do that, whereas another one won't. We will add grant and support funding and programming to provide for that, to allow for those to make themselves, not to mention the fact keeping them safe after hours when they're not being utilized, because sometimes there's vandalism and other uses that happen that some people are able to effectively defend and others won't. So we don't ask people, we don't want people to start to pay for these until maybe 2023. We're going to forego that. We're going to have an adjustment level in terms of what the permit fee would be. There'll be additional grants and supports for those to make them either defensible or upgrade them. So there's a whole host of things that we're trying to do. And all of this is under the guise of, you know, I would just start by saying, if we tried to do this from scratch in San Francisco, if it had not been for this pandemic, it never would have happened. But when you go around the world, when you go to the Las Ramblas in Barcelona, when you go to Paris, when you go to other places in South America and in Asia, you see this type of use in an urban environment. So someone like myself, who's a trained urban planner, this excites me. And this, as someone that wants to see small businesses survive, this is important to me. As someone that wants to make San Francisco a much more vibrant city, this is an important piece of that. So many times out of a negative, you can get an extreme positive. And for me, the shared spaces is one of those things, an opportunity we can't miss. But we are going to take the time to get it done right.
Well, John King, I want to ask you about that. But before we do, let me say that this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking about making outdoor parklets permanent. Would you like to see outdoor restaurant parklets become something that's always in the city? Or are you upset about the potential noise, loss of parking, or access issues? We want to hear your thoughts. And you can join us by calling us at State of the Bay at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So, John King, we're talking about, you know, what the parklets mean for the city. And I wondered, from an architectural perspective, do you think they add or do they detract from the city's urban architecture?
On the whole, I think they add. I think that the extra liveliness is a plus in most areas. And also, one of the things is, a number of parklets, at their best, the parklets really express the character of the restaurant or cafe that's hosting, you know, that put them out there, where you get creative designs. There's one on Fillmore Street for Woodhouse Fish Company that's shaped like a boat. There are a number on Hayes Street that have some great murals on them. You know, just touches like that can really work well. I think that the problem comes in, and the supervisor was right. I mean, this was done very quickly, and it was done, it instantly became a success, but inevitably you had a lot of restaurateurs pushing the boundaries of what they could do or what they could afford to do. And then you had planners and bureaucrats kind of running to keep up, and then bureaucrats getting unfair flack because they hadn't planned all this out in advance, as if they had 2 years' notice the pandemic was coming. You know, you go to some areas and you see this, like on Green Street, a block of Green Street in North Beach. You see it on Chestnut. You know, you see it where there are so many parklets jammed in that if you're in a car, it is hard to see the sidewalk. It becomes a whole new element defining the street. And if you're in the sidewalk, you can't really see out. It's like you're kind of, you know, going through this funnel of restaurant space. And it gets tricky. And I mean, on the whole, I think they've been a real advantage. But making changes like moving them away from bus stops, thinning things out. I think what you'll see as the economy comes back, I'm guessing, is you'll see a number of these disappear. And I think, you know, Lauren would probably have a better idea on this. Just restaurants will think, okay, this thing's kind of worn down. Do I want to spend X thousand dollars to bring it back? Or realistically, are most of my customers going inside? And it's easier for my strapped, understaffed wait staff to just be working the room rather than working the room and the sidewalk and the parklet. You know, so I think they might thin out, and I think that'll actually be better for the urban realm. you know, the more competition there is, the more creativity. It's good advertising for your restaurant, but it also kind of increases the street ambiance of San Francisco.
Well, John, I think that's a great question. I wanted to ask Lori about that, which is, what about the future of these parklets? Is it like what John King just said, that, you know, restaurants are going to eventually kind of bail on these,
some,
on these parklets?
Not all, and just some.
And some of them. Yeah, I don't want to, I'm not, I don't want to misquote you, so I appreciate that. And actually, we have a listener comment kind of along those lines that says, this person says, I like the idea of the parklets better than the reality. I ate dinner at a restaurant in the marina, and I was freezing. The wind was whipping, and even though I was wearing a down jacket, by the end of the meal, my fingers were numb. Next time, I will eat inside. So, you know, maybe this speaks a little bit to John's point that with the with COVID gone, you know, our restaurant's going to want, many restaurants going to want to continue with this model.
So I think, like everything else I get asked, I wish I had a crystal ball and I could tell you what's going to happen. So I think what we need to do is wait and see. I know many of us need these extra seats in a parking space. Without the social distancing, we can seat probably 20 seats, you know, or you know, five tables of up to four. For those 20 seats, we're employing one to two additional workers, or to John's point, when we're short-staffed, one to two additional shifts. So it could be the same worker who's picking up two more full shifts and getting, you know, tips and adding hours for their eligibility for other benefits. This is in addition to the kitchen that you're re-employing. So these are really job creators and job sustainers, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. Now, whether we're going to be able to actually have customers still want to sit outside, I don't know. And we're just going to have to wait and see. Remember, not everybody's comfortable eating inside yet. We're entertaining some family friends. They're all vaccinated. We're all in our, you know, late 50s, early 60s, and they adamantly do not want to sit inside. So we are sitting outside tomorrow. I'm wearing what I have for a year, Uggs, jeans, three or four layers, and maybe a ski coat, you know, because we don't have the heating where we're going to be seating. And, you know, we'll see that continue. So I think that obviously if people sit inside and the demand for outside goes down, then they will naturally die off. However, to the supervisor's point, and I want to, you know, I want to weigh in on this, Europeans have eaten outside for years. And as our weather gets better and hopefully the fall, we'll see so much demand for that outside seating. So it may just shift back and forth from, do you sit inside or outside, largely based on weather. More than anything, I think I'm not a crystal ball person, but that's what we see with normal behavior in the restaurant industry. So I do also want to say that, to the point somebody mentioned, I'm sorry who it is, the advertising is fascinating. So one of my restaurants is way down at the end of Union Street. It's been around for 15 years, and we have had people who have come in who have been like, my God, we've walked past this every day. We had no idea there was a restaurant here. Now, you could say I suck at advertising and social media, but I'm just telling you that we are hearing that from New York. We're hearing that from all over the city, that it does kind of raise the awareness that there is something going on. And then people see people out there and then they want to come and eat out there.
Yeah, well, we have a listener comment who seems similar to you. I love the restaurant parklets, our listener writes. A Latin American restaurant near where I live decorated theirs with colorful panels, and it livens up the neighborhood. Yesterday afternoon, there was a large family celebrating a birthday, and all the passersby joined in to sing happy birthday. So, I mean, to the point, they are really fun. And, I mean, when the weather is warm, as in the fall, I think they're great. I wonder, is the cost of them worth it, though? I mean, you're talking a lot, Lori, about the people they employ, but are they expensive to maintain and operate? I mean, the propane tanks alone feel kind of a lot.
Well, yeah, so let me just tell you, they're cheaper than paying a landlord rent. So that additional, no, I'm serious.
Yes.
The additional seating and the money that comes in for those seatings, really, and that's another thing we want to remember. It gives us the ability to bring in money that can be used for other things that isn't going to pay the, you know, and nothing against landlords, but I mean, usually that's a huge chunk of the money that comes into a restaurant goes back out to pay the landlords, because most of us don't own our properties.
Right.
Well, I wanted to ask about the loss of parking spaces and how this has engendered some opposition to these parklets. And there's a listener comment along these lines who writes, so restaurants will continue to be using these spaces for free. It might be appropriate to charge them something, especially as this will be expanding their seating capacity substantially and thereby their earnings, not to mention all the lost parking spaces and revenue therefrom. And Supervisor Safai, maybe I could direct that one to you. What have you been hearing about locals who are concerned about the loss of parking spaces? How does that fit into the city's overall plan for mobility and access?
Well, you know, first of all, let me just say this. I tried to say this, I probably said it in a quick way. We're giving people a couple of different options. Some, and you see this in North Beach, you see this in the Visitor, you see this in other areas, they can set up their shared space, their parklet, temporarily. Maybe it's for lunch, maybe it's for dinner, and then it's removed. There's others that are more permanent. So there's three different options in the permit process. So that gives you a different level of... But secondarily, let's just have an honest conversation about that. I mean, in a lot of these places, the meters would go to 6 o'clock, they would go to 8 o'clock, and someone would just park there for the rest of the night. So on Grant Avenue, for example, or over in North Beach, for example, you were never getting a parking space anyway. It was only if you lived in that area that you were able to get that spot and you got it there. Maybe you got there at 5:30, you took that spot, and then you got a spot for the rest of the night. I think, and by the way, the people that would be complaining the loudest would be the businesses, because they would say, my customers don't have access to parking. My customers don't have the turnover. But that's not what you're hearing. The trade-off is so much more. The access, and Lori said it best. If you think about the amount of space some of these restaurants have, think about it. If I ask you right now, Ethan, or anyone on this call, where can I go in the city for a party of 10 that I want to have a birthday party, or I want to have a dinner, or I want to... So many of these restaurants are constrained by, they can't seat more than 5 or 6 people. That is their capacity. They might have one table, and that table turns over less frequently all night, that you've got like 8 or 10 people. But now what you've done is you've created this additional space for them. And by the way, it's not free. City's getting a fee for it. There's a permit. Right now, we've designed it as kind of an economic recovery process. Eventually, there will be a cost recovery. There will be a fee associated with it, but we've reduced that to ensure that we're trying to. I mean, let me just tell you, the back rent that many of these restaurants and cafes are facing is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Many of the same places that people feel that are San Francisco institutions, they will be gone unless we come up with a plan. We have done multiple things. One is this shared space. Another one is this food delivery program to seniors and people that are homebound that's called New Deal and Great Plates. Another one is we're going to have an economic relief program designed to help people with their commercial rent. I'm working on that right now with the mayor and others here on the board. But we're trying to think of ways that we can help sustain and revitalize our economy. And to John King's point, how we can reimagine the urban space and the urban environment. So the idea of losing parking, I think, is less of an issue ultimately, because so many of those spaces ultimately never turned over on a nightly basis, at least from the commercial point of view. From the residential point of view, maybe you have some arguments there. But ultimately, I think the vast majority of people are going to be able to utilize these spaces and patronize these businesses.
All right. Well, John, let me go to you. First of all, the supervisor really underscored just the dire economics here. But first, from a design standpoint, given your role at the Chronicle and your expertise on the subject, what would be some of the features that you would like to see incorporated in these parklets going forward? Or if you could make a recommendation for city policy as they make this policy potentially permanent for city leaders, what would you recommend? What would you like to see replicated going forward?
I would keep a lot of what is in place in place. The rules that were put together, and the supervisor talked about this, they were changed about 3 times in the first 6 months or so, because the first round of parklets, a lot of restaurant owners essentially went to Home Depot or Lowe's and bought pre-made stretches of 6-foot tall fences and then put them up around the parking space they got. So you couldn't see in, you couldn't see out. It was unsafe. It was kind of bleak. It was like you were walling everything off. So the rules were changed that you dropped down to 4 feet. There was the issue of safety, of making sure that there was a jersey barrier or something at one end that could resist small impacts from cars, you know, like just jumping forward or something. You know, so I think a lot of the, and then also accessibility. Initially, there was a real problem with that. And the rules that have been put in place do make provisions for accessible access. Obviously, you've got to be monitoring all this. But I think a lot of the key, I would love it if the city would create a small subsidy fund where, like, if you were doing a parklet and you wanted to get a muralist and you were cash strapped, you could have access to someone who would do the work for you. I mean, you know, just there are very simple things that can be done so that it's not just kind of a chintzy, grim looking tatty thing, you know, that falls down if we ever have a good bout of rain again. The other thing, I don't know how this would be done. I would not want to be the supervisors or the regulators. I think you could make a case for only a certain number per block and somehow figuring out how to manage that, because you do kind of get to a point where there's the parking issue, but I think more than that, the visibility issue, the rest, the, you know, some of our retail strips essentially are restaurant, dining, cafe strips, but others still have a lot of mix of resident serving retail in there. And if no one can see that the laundromat or the independent bookstore is still in business when they're going by on the street, be it on bicycle or driving, they might just assume it closed. You know, so I don't know how to work that out.
Hmm.
The other thing, and this is in one of the amendments that went through committee last week, was the talk of looking at the really heavy streets going back in a year or two or three and like, okay, the 500 block of Green Street is insanely overdone. We need to think about wider sidewalks just to handle kind of the dining demand and the patronage demand. So it's essentially, I think the key, just to keep it real short, is that the business owners need to realize this is part of their business, and a big part of their business relies on not alienating people in the neighborhood around them. If you put up kind of a cattle car to cram as many people as you can in and wrap it up in ventilate, you know, wrap it up in plastic that isn't supposed to be there under the code, that's going to backfire on you in the long term. If you have a creative design, not expensive, just, you know, laser cutting the wood kind of, the plywood type of thing, and a mural and all, it creates a good tone for your business.
Well, I wanted to give, as we wrap this segment up, Lori, I wanted to give you the last word. What do you think about what John suggested, and what do you hope for going forward?
Well, I do think there's a lot of considerations. Just to address one point is that my understanding is that the businesses, basically the restaurants, would have the ability to do the parklet or the outside space in front of their storefront. And that, right. I know that it was only spilled over if the other businesses had allowed it. And I believe that that provision is still in there, that you would need an approval if you were going to take an adjacent storefront that wasn't in front of your business. So I'll just put that out there, that I think there is some ways to address that. I believe in the legislation going forward is that. I do think that you're right, John. I mean, people are attracted to places that are beautiful and appealing and safe, and that it will have some self-selection going forward. And I just want to reiterate that everybody's working really hard to try to do this to the best of our abilities. And this is so desperately needed for employment, for trying, like the supervisor said, to try to help some of these businesses survive. I get asked every day, so how many are going to be permanently failed? And I was like, look, we don't know that yet. And we're trying to avoid that. We're trying not to have, even worse, you guys, you know, blocks of empty storefronts, blocks of boarded up stuff like we did for the 7 months that our businesses were closed with plywood all over. And we're trying to have an economic recovery that we need for sales tax and to help fund things like Muni and things like that. So we're trying for a win-win. And I just really ask that we all try to work together to try to, and then there needs to be enforcement. We'll sign up for that with the GGRA. We want everybody to make sure there's clear passages and that we trust our neighbors and can work together and things like that. So this is a big lift, but we can do this.
Well, and we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, because we're running out of time. But John King is the urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Lori Thomas is the executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. She's the owner of Nice Ventures, which currently owns and manages Roses and Terrazzo, Roses Cafe and Terrazzo in San Francisco. Thanks for joining us, John and Lori.
And next up, stay with us because we're going to stay with Supervisor Safai to talk about San Francisco's shoplifting surge. You're listening to State of the Bay.
Days when you walk into a Walgreens store, how many of the items are behind lock and key?
It's very true, Grace. Just the other day, I had to ask the person behind the desk to actually unlock the cabinet just so I could buy some toothpaste.
Well, as you know, those measures have been put in place by stores because they're finding shoplifting to be an increasingly thorny problem for them in San Francisco. Theft in Walgreens stores in San Francisco is four times the average for stores elsewhere in the country, and the chain spends 35 times more on security guards in San Francisco than in other locations.
Well, it's definitely a troubling trend, and it's caught the attention of some of our city's leaders, including Supervisor Asha Safai, who, as we mentioned in the earlier segment, represents San Francisco's 11th district, and it's home to a number of stores that have been experiencing the shoplifting surge. Supervisor Safai, we're so glad that you can stick with us on State of the Bay for this segment.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Not necessarily happy to be here to talk about this particular issue. But one of the things that we uncovered, and this was shocking to me, I knew that we had retail theft. I knew that we had an issue with shoplifting. What I didn't understand or know was that this was part of an organized crime syndicate, that we are one of the cities that has one of the highest rates of organized crime retail theft in the country. And I'll be honest with you, this past weekend, wanted to take my mother, elderly mother. She wanted to go to the Gap. They're all gone. And I spoke to this in San Francisco. I spoke to the CEO 2 months ago, and she said directly the result of theft and shoplifting. Spoke with Walgreens, spoke with Safeway, spoke with CVS. They all have organized crime individuals on their staff focused on this issue. So we've sent a letter of inquiry to our district attorney and our police chief. We're going to push this issue because we understand that this is something that if we don't turn around, you know, no matter what we do to build on the last conversation about shared spaces and reimagining our urban environment, many of these stores will shut down. They'll shut down forever.
Right. And it's such a huge problem that, I mean, we see the kind of the blight of all these stores closing. And for particularly, I find that the CVS and the Walgreens, you know, they are such lifelines for people. People get their prescriptions there. What are your constituents saying about how it's affecting them?
Well, I mean, in general, first of all, people don't feel safe. They see certain aspects. I mean, they see certain products that they just cannot get access to. And it's important. It's important to be able to go to your neighborhood, down the street from your house, in your environment, and be able to access basic services. And to see those disappearing or under assault is something that has to be one of the highest priorities for this city. So it definitely affects, and it impacts the adjacent retail. And so this to me is a super priority. We're going to continue to push this issue. The thing that was amazing is when you hear that these places, and some people will fall back on Prop 47, they'll say, oh, we reformed our misdemeanor theft, and that's the reason. It's not true. It really and truly is organized retail crime. People are given a list. They're asked to look for over-the-counter medicines. They're looked at as for cosmetics, and they will hit 10 to 15 stores in a day, and they will come back with, you know, thousands of dollars worth of goods. The district attorney, the police department have the ability to do what's called aggregate charges. Someone is involved in that type of theft in multiple locations. It's not staying under the Prop 47 mandated amount. So this is an important thing, and we're going to continue to push this and ensure that we come up with a coordinated strategy to mitigate this.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking with Supervisor Asha Safai, represents District 11 in San Francisco, about the recent rise in shoplifting that's hit the areas, retail stores all across San Francisco. We want to hear from you if you have been impacted by this rise in shoplifting, if you have thoughts about what's causing it or how we could address it. We do want to hear from you, and you can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. And Supervisor Safai, I wanted to follow up on the comment you just made that this is not about individual shoplifters, which, you know, you'd otherwise maybe assume, given the fact that this rise in shoplifting has coincided with the pandemic, that it might be people driven by poverty to do this.
Right.
But you've talked about how this is an organized crime kind of effort. Do you have any sense as to what the causes are of that? Why is this hitting now? What are some of the underlying factors here? And I'm just wondering if you could offer a little bit more specifics too on what law enforcement needs to do here to really get around this.
Yeah. So based on the information that we received from some of the major anchor retailers, they have estimates that 85% or more of their retail theft is organized retail crime. Only about 15% are what they call crimes of opportunity, people that might, you know, be desperate or in need or, you know, based on poverty or otherwise. 85%. I think this is something that has maybe gone on for some time. More recently, it has seen a major spike. And the words that the Director of Organized Retail Crime Abatement and CVS use is that San Francisco, in his opinion, was one of the epicenters of this in the United States. I think that Amazon Marketplace does not help. I think the inability or the lack of charges being brought, as I said, aggregate charges being brought against individuals is a problem for San Francisco, because other localities and other places are doing it. And other localities and places are focusing their energy and effort on trying to mitigate this. Now, this is not to say this doesn't happen in other parts of the country, but when we saw a comparison of Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, we were by far an outlier. That says something about what is happening in San Francisco. There needs to be better coordination between the district attorney and the police department. There needs to be better use of technology. In a lot of those other locales, they have surveillance cameras, and surveillance is used to make the case against individuals that are utilizing hitting multiple locations. These are things that we need to explore, and we need to explore aggressively.
I want to address this idea of using cameras. You know, people, if you look in the newspaper, people are constantly saying, oh, my garage got broken. I have some video of it, but nothing's going to be done about it because the police aren't going to do anything. Do you really think that that there's the will to prosecute these crimes? I mean, you're saying that maybe that doesn't exist. And is that a DA problem or is that a police problem?
You know, we need to get to the bottom of it. I can't say with 100% certainty. I'm not laying the blame yet at anyone's doorstep. We sent our letter of inquiry to the district attorney. We sent our letter of inquiry to the police chief. We are going to push for better coordination. We're going to push for a coordinated strategy. We are going to require them to come and present their information and findings to our board of supervisors. We are going to ensure that this is a priority for San Francisco. As I said, when our hometown, one of our hometown businesses like The Gap has one retail location left in the city, when we've lost 17 Walgreens over the last 5 years, that is a significant blow to our local economy, as a significant blow to surrounding small businesses that feed off of it, to our seniors, our family members, those that rely on these services and goods. This is an important thing. And I'm ringing the alarm now, and we're going to have, hopefully by the 16th and in a couple of weeks, we're going to have a response from our letter of inquiry. But we are going to ensure that this is a top priority, and we're going to continue to push that.
Well, and you mentioned that you don't attribute the rise.
And I'm sorry. And to answer your question about technology and surveillance directly, there has been some resistance in certain areas for the use of cameras, for the use of surveillance. But, you know, I think from talking to the police chief, that's one of the things that he is saying that they do a better job of utilizing in other locales. And in San Francisco, I can tell you, when I first came into office, there was an area of my district that had multiple murders. And the police chief came and said to me, he said, you could put as many officers on this beat as you want. I could put a substation here if you want. But if you put up surveillance cameras, it will have a dramatic impact. And I was very skeptical. To this day, since we have put on up those cameras, there has not been one murder in that area. So I am a firm believer. I am 100% for people's civil liberties. I'm 100% of them being monitored in a fair and equitable way. But if we want to do some significant crime abatement, we're going to have to have a serious conversation about that as well.
So we've only got just a couple minutes left in this segment, but I wanted to ask you a question from a listener who says, does locking up toothpaste help? Because it's depressing and inconvenient. So maybe Supervisor Safai, just final thoughts on shoplifting and its impact on residents. I mean, what is your response to the impact that residents are feeling, and particularly when it's measures like the fact that we now have to lock up things like toothpaste? What is your response on that?
I mean, I was down in Redwood City yesterday visiting a friend. I had to stop in the Walgreens. I didn't see anything behind lock and key. The Walgreens on Geneva and Mission, half the store seems empty. Many of the products have just been removed from the shelves. They don't even offer them anymore. The ones that are there, they're behind lock and key. It's bad for business. It's bad for the morale. It's bad. It sends the wrong message about the neighborhood. We have been able to, with some foot patrols, change the tide in one of the areas of our. But you can't have a police officer on every corner. So we're going to be promoting what we're calling community ambassadors, having individuals out there with some of our local community-based organizations. They know individuals from the community. They're from the community. We're going to try and stop and deter that level of activity before it even happens. And, you know, in certain areas, Walgreens and some of the other places, very similar to what they do in Apple, they might have to limit the number of people that go into the store at the same time, because it can't just be removing all the products. And that hurts community. It definitely
absolutely
does.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate you coming on the program and talking about this shoplifting surge. Supervisor Ashaw Safai, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you, Ethan. And it's Asha like Sasha. Thank you.
Thank you. And next Alrighty. Up, Joseph Pache's interview with Pulitzer Prize winning author John Branch. Stay with us. Last week, Joseph Pache spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Branch. Stay tuned to hear about the stories in his new book, Side Country.
John Branch, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As a journalist, you've written over 2,000 stories that have been published in the New York Times. Your new book, Side Country, contains 20 of those stories. How do you decide which pieces to pull in for the book?
Yeah, so the pieces that I pulled in for this book are ones that have meant the most to me over the years. Some of them got some attention at the time that they ran. Some of them kind of flew under the radar, but these are the ones that really stuck with me over the past decade or so.
And why the title Side Country?
Well, so Side Country is a term borrowed from skiing. It means the area right outside of a ski area. And it came up in one of the stories that I wrote called Snowfall, about an avalanche that happened in the side country. But I also thought it was a pretty good metaphor for the kind of work that I like to do, which is just outside of the boundaries of sports, a little on the edge, but not so far away, not in the backcountry, just relatable, but a little bit beyond the boundaries.
So you live here in the Bay Area, yet obviously readers of the New York Times are all over the country. When you sit down to write a story, do you think about how your story might be read by different regions of this country, especially in these politically polarized times? Or do the sports and events you write about somehow transcend this red state, blue state trope?
Yeah, a lot of my stories aren't very political. There are some exceptions to that. But I do think about the people who are reading the story. You know, I write a lot about subjects that don't get written about a lot, at least to a mainstream audience. Things like climbing, I've written about things like Rubik's Cubes. A lot of these subjects are not familiar to the readers, and that's one of the challenges I have. And so knowing that there are people all over the world that don't know a lot about the subject, I have to think about the way I explain these things. And so when I'm talking about climbing, I need the person on the Upper East Side of New York, or the person in Hong Kong, or the person in the middle of the flatlands of America to understand what it's like on the wall of El Capitan in Yosemite. I'm not reaching out to the climbers necessarily. Most of the audience, of course, is not the climber.
So several of your stories are set here in the Bay Area. One of them is especially moving, The Girl in the Number 8 Jersey, where one of your daughter's soccer teammates loses her mother to the mass shooting in Las Vegas. And you write about the girl's hometown, Novato, and how it responds in the wake of the tragedy. Tell us about that story and how you decided to cover it.
Yeah, so I live in Novato, and I've received a call in the middle of the night from editors saying, can you get to Las Vegas as soon as possible? There has been a mass shooting overnight. And so I did. I went down to SFO and jumped on the first plane I could get and got to Las Vegas. And once I was there, I got a text from my wife saying one of the mothers from my girl's soccer team was missing, and found out by the end of the day that Stacey Etcheber had been one of the victims, the 50-some victims of that mass shooting. I spent a week in Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay in a suite exactly similar to the one that the shooter used to kill all those people, overlooking the ground there where the concert was, and reporting that story like I do. That's what journalists do. But meanwhile, back in Novato, I was really missing the heart of the story, the real story, in many ways. And that was a community that was trying to heal. That was a community hanging ribbons, doing all the things that we've now come to see during these tragedies. Putting out memorials, lighting candles, coming together at night for vigils, baking for each other and cooking for each other. And here I was in Las Vegas at the scene of the story, but not really feeling the story. And it wasn't until I returned a week later and got home just in time, purposely, to catch my daughter's soccer game. And the little girl whose mother had been killed ended up playing at that soccer game and ended up scoring the winning goal. And I, along with all the other parents there, just lost it. It's the first time I had cried all week. And it just tells you that, you know, it's just a soccer game, right? But there's something there that it still chokes me up just talking about it. And that story ends the collection, and it ends it for a reason, because it means more to me than anything else.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing that. Moving to a different story, in Children of the Cube, you have a personal connection to that story when you're covering the nationals of the Rubik's Cube competition. Your son is one of the competitors, and you convey an appreciation for the social aspects of these competitions, for the kids that they draw in. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so my son picked up a Rubik's Cube a few years ago and got to be pretty good at it. He could solve it within 12 or 13 seconds, which sounds incredibly fast, but there are kids that can do it in a matter of 4 or 5 seconds. But he was competing at cube competitions all around the Bay Area. And I thought it was an interesting story because my son always struggled to fit in, struggled to make friends, struggled to connect with kids. And he found his tribe through cubing. I would go to these events and really see him connect with kids in ways that he never did anywhere else. And I realized, talking to parents and other kids, that was true for a lot of them too. And so I decided to write that as a story, and we went to the Nationals. My son qualified for the Nationals, and we watched kids connecting through speed cubing, as it's called. And the editors, after I wrote that story, decided it needed more of my son and me in it, that the heart of the story was really about me and my son. So I was a little loath to do it. I don't like to inject myself in these stories, but that story ended up being another personal one to me, as my son and I experienced this together and watching him grow through this funny little world of speed cubing.
Wow. It just goes back to having a sense of connection to others through these pursuits, even for people who would struggle with doing that. I'm thinking of myself as a child not fitting in often, and sports never seemed like the place that I would find community. And to hear your son's story of a place where a competition could bring him a sense of validation and connection is quite heartening. Moving to the story called The Most Perilous Prize, you talk about the sport of abalone diving in Northern California and how every year a number of divers actually lose their lives in pursuit of hunting a very limited number of red abalone. Tell us more about that.
You know, I had moved to California. My wife is from the Bay Area, so we moved here about 2012 and was reading in the paper. It seemed like every month or two, somebody else had drowned on the northern coast of California, abalone hunting. And, you know, I thought there's a broader story here. What is abalone hunting and why are people willing to basically lose their lives potentially to do this? At the time, there were anywhere from a few to 10 or 12 people who were dying each year abalone diving. It has since stopped, and it's not because of the danger of it. It's because of the population of abalone has gone down so much with climate change generally that they no longer allow most abalone diving. But that story, you know, to your point, was not really a story about abalone diving necessarily, although I think it took readers into a world that they probably didn't understand, certainly outside Northern California. But it's a story about people who are passionate about something and do these kind of quirky things that other people might think are a little nutty or a little off the beaten path, but people believe in it wholeheartedly. And that could be abalone diving or any of these other sports that we're talking about.
There are so many amazing stories in your book, but let's end on your story about the Dipsy Race, which starts in Mill Valley and ends in Stinson Beach. Could you read the opening passage from that story for us?
The toughest part of the Dipsy, said to be the country's oldest trail running race, might not be the first mile, which contains nearly 700 stairs rising through the forests above Mill Valley. It is not the jiggly-legged drop into Muir Woods or the steep rise up Dynamite, so named because your churning legs might feel ready to explode. And it is not even the next big hill, called Cardiac. If your legs have not burst, maybe your heart will. It is not the treacherous plunge toward the ocean, the crooked depths and broken steps of steep ravine, even the poison oak that crowds the skinny trails and tickles the legs before blooming into a post-race rash. And it's not the course's maze of permissible shortcuts, like the one named Suicide, that give locals an advantage as long as they stay upright and do not get lost. No, unexpectedly, the toughest part of the 7.5-mile Dipsy, a topographically schizophrenic romp that was first run in 1905, could be mental. It is knowing that the slowest runners are given head starts, and the fastest ones begin at the back. It is like unloading a zoo's worth of animals in reverse order of mobility and releasing the cheetahs at the end.
So, explain why the race is organized this way.
It's wonderful, and it's the craziest race in the world just because of this point. The idea was, how can we handicap this race so that anybody can win and that the finishes are going to be exciting? And so unlike most running races where they put the people who are the most elite runners at the very front, who then lead the entire way, have no obstacles in front of them, they stick the most elite runners at the very back. And they stick young kids, grandmothers, grandfathers at the very front. And so it forces people to have to navigate through these crazy trails up and over the shoulder of Mount Tam past all these people. Most elite runners don't like to do it because it's hard and it's dangerous and it's annoying, but it's what gives the race its uniqueness, and it's a wonderful, wonderful event.
And so you actually ran the Dipsy. I wonder how many sports writers actually get to compete in the races that they write about. How did you do?
I did okay. I got passed by a lot more people than I passed. But I survived. I had a great time. And I decided I didn't need to do it again.
One and done. My understanding is that it's the 110th running of the Dipsy race this year, and it'll be on November 7th instead of its usual run in June. Is that right?
I think that's right. Yep, they missed it last year, obviously. So,
well, John Branch, it was a pleasure having you on State of the Bay. Congratulations on your new book, Side Country, Tales of Death and Life from the Backroads of Sports.
Thank you, Joseph.
That was co-host Joseph Pache interviewing author John Branch. You can pick up his latest book, Side Country, to read more riveting stories about ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
And well, that's State of the Bay this week.
Thanks to all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation.
Ethan, what's up for the next week's show?
Well, next week, we'll do a deep dive on the drought in California, and we'll hear your interview, Grace, with San Francisco Pride Board President Carolyn Weisinger.
And if you have a question for next week's show, call and leave a message at 415-580-0718, or you can email us at stateofthebay@klw.org, or tweet us. We're at State of Bay.
And for a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on klw.org.
Our engineer this evening was the amazing D Minor, and tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Ann Harper.
I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Grace Wan.
Good night, and thanks so much for listening.
Stay safe and join us next Monday at 6.
Hi, I'm Carol Off, co-host of As It Happens, bringing you the stories behind the stories of the day, Mondays through Thursdays at 11 p.m., heard only in the Bay Area on KALW San Francisco.
At 91.7 FM and online at KALW.org. Where Q from the CBC is next.
Hi, I'm Sandra Oh.
Hey, I'm James Bay.
Hi, I'm Rupert Everett.
Hey, this is Maggie Rogers.
And you are listening to Q.
You're listening to Q.
You're listening to Q.
And you're listening to Q.